This is definitely an irritant for other foreign policy goals. And it looks like the administration has made a trade-off between wanting to put maximum pressure on Iran and perhaps putting that ahead of some of these other foreign policy goals that they have.
And that includes China, and it includes India. More in a moment. This is Friday, May 3rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, wealthy governments are facing barriers to the trash in Southeast Asia. We take you to India, where millennials are having a say in the election there, and journalists face more and more dangers as we observe Press Freedom Day. All on today's VOA Asia. The United States is tightening its economic sanctions on Iran by ending a set of waivers that had allowed some of the country's largest oil buyers to continue their purchases. With the expiration of waivers for eight buyers, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the United States would be exerting maximum pressure on the Iranian government. The move is the latest in a series of steps the United States has taken since President Trump took office with a pledge to withdraw from the international agreement that limited Iran's nuclear program in exchange for relief from economic sanctions. Trump announced the withdrawal in May of 2018, and new sanctions went into place in November with oil purchase waivers in place for China, India, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Turkey, Italy, and Greece. Joining us is Samantha Gross, foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Samantha, thanks so much for being with us. So far, we haven't heard anything from China, at least, as beyond complaining. About what has happened. There were reports of some oil tankers off the eastern coast of China that were just waiting there, although some movement had been reported down towards some oil refineries, the biggest in China. What does this do, as far as you can tell me, to the relationships that Washington has with Asian nations?
You know, the Asian nations were taken by surprise when Washington pulled back the sanctions, and they didn't give them very much notice that they were going to pull back the sanctions either. And so there was definitely some consternation among Iran's customers in Asia and some surprise that they couldn't buy Iranian crude.
So what happens now? Do you think that China is going to go ahead and continue consuming Iranian oil? The same with India. Already Taiwan has said it would not. I'm not sure about South Korea, but what do you think is happening here?
Well, the China situation is the most interesting one to start out with. The Chinese are particularly frustrated at the U.S. imposing multilateral sanctions. And the Chinese already have one or more banks that are under sanctions. And so they're likely to continue buying some Iranian crude through entities that are already sanctioned. Certainly the main Chinese banks don't want to deal with U.S. sanctions and they won't touch these deals. But there are some entities in China that may be willing to finance these deals and to facilitate them. The other countries are much more likely to comply. India is frustrated with us, but I think India is likely to comply. Taiwan and South Korea are likely to comply for the most part. I think the really interesting question is in China.
Well, China and India, according to some reports, are trying to set up a block, a trading block, as far as oil is concerned. What can you tell us about that?
You know, they're trying to set up entities where they can obtain Iranian oil without going through the U.S. banking sector, which is where the sanctions would come in. This is a tricky thing for us because it's an advantage for the United States that oil is priced in U.S. dollars. And so mechanisms that move away from pricing oil in U.S. dollars are probably not best for the United States in the long run. But they're also challenging for Iran. Rather than having hard currency for their oil, they might get paid in rupees or in renminbi, and that is not ideal for them. However, it's better than not selling that oil at all.
So do you think this is a done deal? Some Chinese officials were in India last week, apparently talking about it. And do you think that the U.S. or President Trump, as the case may be, made the wrong decision as far as deciding not to extend the exclusivity?
The I'm not sure if it's a done deal. I know they're talking about it. Whether or not he made the right decision is a really tricky one. It's a geopolitical question. I know he feels strongly that he really wants to bring Iran's exports to zero to maximize pressure on Iran. But you have to think about how that affects our allies, particularly India, that has significant purchases from Iran and will have to do some reshuffling to replace those, and how this plays out in the Chinese trade negotiations that are going on right now. This is definitely an irritant for other foreign policy goals. And it looks like the administration has made a trade-off between wanting to put maximum pressure on Iran and perhaps putting that ahead of some of these other foreign policy goals that they have.
So where do you think this puts, what effect this might have on the U.S. trade negotiation, U.S.-China trade negotiations?
You know, there's definitely a lot of impetus for both sides to come to a deal on the trade negotiations. They both like to see the tariffs come to an end. President Trump, I believe, is really wanting to have a deal in hand. And so there's still a lot of pressure for them to get that deal done. But this is definitely a bit of sand in the gears of that agreement. I mean, I think the real question is, it's not clear what the administration's endgame is on Iran. They've made a series of demands that are almost impossible for Iran to meet. So they're very focused on putting a lot of pressure on Iran, on bringing those oil exports to zero. But it's not clear exactly where this game is going or what it is that the Iranians might do that would bring the sanctions to an end.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. Hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated along India's eastern coast Thursday as authorities braced for Cyclone Fani, expected to make landfall Friday with 200 kilometer per hour winds. Human Rights Watch says Chinese authorities are using a mass surveillance app to profile, investigate, and detain Muslims in the northwestern region of Xinjiang. Catholic church leaders in Sri Lanka have canceled Sunday services for another week, citing what these said are specific security concerns following attacks last month at churches and hotels that killed more than 250 people. And Myanmar security forces shot dead at least six people in the troubled western state of Rakhine Thursday after a military spokesman said soldiers and police detained hundreds of people at a school. VOA Asia continues now. Wealthy countries are exporting millions of tons of plastic waste to Southeast Asia, where the recycling systems are becoming overwhelmed, thus leading to widespread pollution problems, according to an investigation by Greenpeace. The environmental organization says that while wealthier countries boast of their advanced recycling collection systems, the plastic can often end up being exported and eventually incinerated, buried in landfills, or simply polluting the land and the oceans. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
50 kilometres outside Kuala Lumpur, in the middle of a palm oil plantation, mountains of plastic waste lay abandoned. Much of it has travelled thousands of kilometres from wealthy countries in Europe and North America. Environmentalist Pua Le Peng says local residents are suffering the consequences.
They just dump the non-recyclable plastic or the reject product, and then they burn in the backyard of this factory. So those toxic fumes actually already cause a lot of health problems to our residents.
Last year, China banned the import of plastic waste, sending a global industry into turmoil. Speaking by Skype, Greenpeace East Asia senior campaigner Kate Lin says wealthy countries are exporting their own plastic waste problems overseas.
They have a good collections facilities, but actually they like sending like half of their collected waste to other countries. Before the China ban, they just send to China for recycling, but they do not take this further step to ensure those recyclable are properly recycled. And now, after the China waste ban, they just find another new places to send their recyclable to.
The Greenpeace report says more than half of that waste, 3 million tons a year, is being redirected toward Southeast Asia, including Malaysia, Vietnam and Thailand.
They do not have the enough capacities for handling such a large amount of import foreign waste. So there is a local solutions to the local environment.
In response, many Southeast Asian countries are imposing their own restrictions on plastic waste imports, forcing the trash into less regulated markets such as Indonesia and India. At a United Nations conference in Geneva this week, 180 countries are discussing a proposal to force plastic waste exporters to receive permission from destination countries in advance, a system known as prior informed consent. Pua Le Peng says for those dealing with the impact, the changes can't come soon enough.
We are killing ourselves by using too many plastic. We too depend on plastic. Please manage and handle your own trash. Don't dump to our country.
Greenpeace says the ultimate solution does not lie in improving recycling, but in cutting back drastically on plastic production and consumption worldwide. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Happening now in Asia, an ex-CIA agent has pleaded guilty to spying for China. That word from the U.S. Justice Department in a case believed to be linked to the dismantling of a U.S. espionage network. 54-year-old Jerry Chun-Ching Lee left the CIA in 2007 to live in Hong Kong, where he was recruited by Chinese agents. You're listening to VOA Asia. In India, one of the world's youngest countries, a staggering 85 million young voters have joined the electoral rolls in this year's general election, which wraps up on May 19th. It is a fiercely fought contest between Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, the main opposition Congress Party, and an array of smaller regional parties. Anjana Pasricha met millennials in one of the country's premier universities to find out that they want Indian politicians to focus on creating better opportunities and improving governance and development.
After classes, conversations among undergraduates in Delhi University often veer to a new subject during election season: what they want in return for their vote. The list is long.
We need jobs, we need safety, we need basic necessities, we need social equality, we need to work on the class divides that exist in the country, we need all of these things, we need development.
Aspirational young voters are making their choices count. 5 years ago, they were fired up by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's promises of jobs and development.
What happened in 2014, the turnout of young voters went up very high. It actually surpassed the average turnout, and they voted decisively, and that made a huge difference to the electoral outcome.
But as unemployment rises to nearly 7% despite a growing economy, that euphoria has gone. And headlines showing that joblessness is even higher among graduates worry college students.
What's the point of you studying in a good college and then going abroad to study, abroad to pursue your job? You should stay in India and do your job. That's the thing. So I think there should be more, you know, jobs created for the youth.
There are other concerns. Preparing to step out of college, a member of the LGBT community worries whether liberal spaces will shrink if Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party retains power. Modi's
Sarkar. One major concern for me is how this will translate into the real world, whether I'll be as accepted or whether I'll always have to like hide myself or my identity.
Despite such criticism, many remain optimistic that compared to his opponents, Modi is better suited to deliver on the development agenda they want.
I'm expecting that Modi will keep on doing the same work in coming years also, if he got a chance.
Recent surveys bear out that Prime Minister Modi retains the edge over his main rival, Rahul Gandhi of the Congress Party, among young voters.
They may be having some anxieties about promises not being fulfilled, what promises were made in 2014. But largely, image of Modi of being a strong leader, a decisive leader, and an honest prime minister, that's a big attraction for large section of voters.
With the race expected to be tight, that attraction could be key in determining whether Modi gets to rule the world's largest democracy for a second time. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Coming your way, a new report that runs counter to Press Freedom Day. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America. This news from VOA Asia. Sources familiar with the case tell the Los Angeles Times that the family of a Chinese student admitted to Stanford paid $6.5 million to the man at the heart of the college admission scandal, whom they met through a Morgan Stanley financial advisor. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and to share. This is VOA Asia. World Press Freedom Day is celebrated on May 3rd each year, but the realities faced by journalists in many parts of the world are increasingly hostile. A new report by an international media watchdog group says press freedoms deteriorated in 2019, fueled in part by increasing aggression toward journalists. Why does a free press matter? VOA's Jessusame Oni has more from this week's Plugged In program with Greta Van Susteren.
Journalists around the world are being targeted as authoritarian governments try to tighten their grip on the media. A new study by Reporters Without Borders says a cycle of fear is diminishing press freedoms around the world and in America. Some call it an attack on the pillars of democracy. Robert Mahoney, Deputy Executive Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
It's the journalists are really on the front lines of holding governments accountable and providing transparency. What is happening to people's rights, how their tax money is spent. And without journalists, governments can implement policies which restrict those rights, and corruption thrives.
Cyber attacks, arrests, and kidnappings are some of the tactics being used to intimidate members of the press, and in some cases, murder. China and North Korea remain listed among the worst offenders in the report. The United States saw a slight decline, dropping 3 points for a problematic climate where reports critical of some in high office is sometimes labeled fake news. Still, journalists say the U.S. Constitution protects and empowers them to continue the work. Amanda Bennett, Agency Director, Voice of America.
That's the difference between us and a lot of the other countries, which is the rule of law. The rule of law exists, and it's by and large respected, and that makes a huge difference between us and the rest of the world. For example, even though Voice of America is funded by the U.S. government, we have laws that keep us separate, so we are truly an independent voice.
In the Philippines, continued threats by President Rodrigo Duterte against the media have contributed to hostilities in a nation once applauded for having one of the greatest press freedoms in Asia. Media watchdogs say his most notable attacks have been against the media outlet Rappler. Maria Risa, CEO and executive editor, Rappler.com.
If you look in the last 14 months, the Philippine government has filed 11 cases against us. In 2 months, I've had to post bail 8 times. And in just 5 weeks, I was arrested twice and detained once. That is an extreme erosion of our freedoms.
In April, Myanmar's top court upheld a 7-year jail sentence for 2 Reuters journalists who were arrested while investigating the killings of Rohingya Muslims in 2017. Stephen Adler, editor-in-chief for Reuters.
The case was clearly a setup. It was clear in every aspect. One of the police witnesses said he had had notes of the arrest, but he had burnt his notes. Another one came in with writing on the side of his hand so he could remember what to say. A third one came in and said that they were instructed to set up our reporters. So there's no question that they were arrested because they were reporting on this massacre.
Norway received the highest rank, while the overall numbers of countries considered safe for the media declined. Jesus Semeoni, VOA News, Washington.
Remember, you can hear and see Plugged In with Greta Van Susteren at voanews.com. This news alert from VOA Asia, the Lotte Group said Thursday it would resume work on a $2.6 billion real estate project in China this month after work was halted following the South Korean firm's decision in 2017 to offer land in South Korea for a U.S. anti-missile system. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, there is increasing tension being applied to the already embattled relations between Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. government. Leaders in the U.S. House of Representatives had harsh words for Attorney General William Barr after he refused to comply with demands related to the special counsel's report on a probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. Barr didn't show up to testify before the House Judiciary Committee Thursday, with the Justice Department objecting to a move to allow committee staff lawyers to take part in the questioning. Beyond Barr's failure to appear, the committee chairman, Jerry Nadler, said he was more concerned about a notice he received from the department saying it was choosing to ignore the committee's subpoena. Nadler warned that Barr's refusals are a threat to congressional oversight of the executive branch and whether Congress can effectively hold the president accountable. He told reporters after the hearing that he plans to hold the attorney general accountable.
We will make one more good faith attempt to negotiate and to get the access to the report that we need. And then, if we don't get that, we will proceed to hold the attorney general in contempt and we'll go from there.
Speaking at her weekly news conference Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi accused Barr of lying to Congress when he testified on April 9th that he was not aware of Mueller's concerns about Barr's version of the special counsel's report, as well as in his testimony before a Senate committee on Wednesday.
He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the President of the United States. And not the attorney general. Being the attorney general does not give you a bath to go say whatever you want, and it is the fact because you are the attorney general. It just isn't true.
A spokeswoman with the Justice Department called Pelosi's characterization of Barr lying to Congress reckless, irresponsible, and false.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say for about the first half of Earth's history, there wasn't enough oxygen in the atmosphere to support complex life. Then between 2.3 and 2.5 billion years ago, a process called the Great Oxidation Event began to create the permanently oxygenated atmosphere that keeps us alive today. Previous research suggested small pockets of oxygen existed in the Earth's shallow oceans years earlier. Now, researchers at Arizona State University say they found evidence that suggests that significant amounts of oxygen were being produced and large-scale oxygenation processes took place in the oceans long before the Great Oxidation Event. Researchers made their findings by analyzing sedimentary rocks that were buried deep underground in Australia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Here are some stories that we will be covering for you at voanews.com in the coming day or so. Hundreds of thousands of people have been evacuated along India's eastern coast as authorities brace for Cyclone Fani, expected to make landfall Friday with 200-kilometer-per-hour winds. Human Rights Watch says Chinese authorities are using a mass surveillance app to profile, investigate, and detain Muslims in the northwestern region of Xinjiang. And the death toll from the Christchurch mosque attacks has risen to 51 after a 46-year-old Turkish man succumbed to injuries sustained in the March 15th shootings. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com, and we'd like to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook, our email is voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.